This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Amy Goodman. She's executive producer and host of Democracy Now!, which airs on KSFR at 6 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon each weekday. Her new book is Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America, co-authored by David Goodman and Dennis Moynihan. She will be speaking on Tuesday, the 26th of April at 7:30 at the Lenzick Center for Performing Arts. It's a benefit for KSFR, KNME, and KUNM, all public media here in New Mexico. Welcome, Amy, to the Radio Cafe.
It's great to be with you.
So let's talk about the book, which is 20th anniversary of Democracy Now!, February 19th, 2016, 20th anniversary of the show. Tell us about the early days. The show was supposed to only go for, I think it was one election cycle, but people had this hunger for the kind of news and information that your show was giving. Describe this to us.
Well, it really was amazing, Mary Charlotte. You have, in 1996, the only daily election show in public broadcasting. It's an interesting sort of nine-month project. We went on the air February 19th, 1996, on nine community radio stations. It was the eve of the New Hampshire primary, and we really sort of wrap up the show and pack our bags right after the election, and that election was the election of Bill Clinton. So, 9 months, very interesting. We're focusing on what people are doing in their communities. You know, most people didn't vote, and when I got the call to host this program, I was in a safe house in Haiti. I was covering elections there. It was post-Aristide coup, the U.S.-backed coup against Aristide between 91 and 94. Extremely dangerous time. People who ran for office would get gunned down. People who voted would meet violence at the polls, but yet most people still voted. And here in this country, the interesting question is, why didn't people vote? They don't face anything like that adversity. And I was interested why. I didn't think people were apathetic. Did they think there wasn't a real choice offered? You know, it was President Clinton in his reelection campaign against Bob Dole and Ross Perot. That was the race that year. So we looked at the primaries as a way to look at what people were doing in their communities. How were people engaged? And of course, there's obstruction to voting, and that's getting worse and worse as the Voting Rights Act is getting gutted all over this country. Millions of people cannot vote. I mean, you look at people who've brushed up against the criminal justice system. In a number of states, if you have a record, if you've been to prison, you cannot ever vote again. Or you might have, you know, it's very complicated when you're on parole, when you're on probation. And then you have the direct opposite, where in Maine and Vermont, prisoners vote from jail. But then you also have just this crackdown right now where look at Phoenix, Arizona, where on their primary day in Phoenix, the authorities decided to save money and cut the polling places from 200 to 60 to save money. So people were waiting online for like 5 hours. Now, a lot of people are not going to wait. If you're working, you can't wait. If you're older, if you're infirm in some way. When I heard that, I thought, why did they stop at 60? Why just close all the polling places? You could save a lot of money. And, you know, these are very serious issues, and there is intent behind them. So in some cases, the voter suppression is completely deliberate. But in other cases, people might be able to vote, but they just don't. And I was interested in that whole gamut. And after the election, there was more demand for the show than before. Because we were giving voice to the grassroots, right? We were not turning to your typical pundits doing the horse race thing that we get so much. You know, he's up, she's down, and how often it is that she's up and he's down, right? That the polls are completely wrong. But that's right. The way they cover these primaries, and I don't think it engenders much enthusiasm on the part of the people of this country. And we wanted to really focus on issues and what people were doing. So there was more demand for the show after the election than before. It started to grow and grow for 5 years. More and more radio stations started to air us. Then the week of September 11, 2001, by chance, we were starting on one public access TV station in New York City down the road from where we were broadcasting from, which was right next to Ground Zero. We were broadcasting from a 100-year-old firehouse that had been converted into a media center serving the community in another way. And so we became emergency broadcasting. Public access stations around the country started saying, could we run your show? The FedEx guys, because I insisted to send this overnight because I thought it was breaking news and I didn't want it to go through the regular mail, would come with sacks to pick up our video cassettes. There was so much demand. And then once we were on these stations, the NPR stations and communities would say, wait, we watch you on television. Could we run this show? And then when it was on NPR, PBS stations were saying, can we run this show? And now we're broadcasting on over 1,400 public television and radio stations around the country and around the world with headlines translated into Spanish in both audio form and transcript on our website at democracynow.org/espanol. And it's just been an astounding growth with a station a week asking to pick us up. And I think, you know, New Mexico is a perfect example of the kind of demand for Democracy Now!, now broadcasting on New Mexico PBS, on KSFR, your station, on KUNM. I mean, it is so exciting to be serving the community in so many different ways, connecting the dots all over the country and around the world.
There's a telling story in the book about how in 1999, Juan Gonzalez, your co-host, asked the New York Daily News, where he's a columnist, to send him to Seattle for the WTO protests. And they didn't even know what he was talking about. And so Democracy Now! Sent him. And then the protests erupted and the Daily News was counting on him for frontline coverage. And they were saying to him, how did you know? And this is something that I've noticed. And in my abundant free time, I would love to do a study on how many stories Democracy Now! Got days, weeks, or sometimes even years before the mainstream or corporate media picked it up. But explain to us why that happens. How does a small media organization like Democracy Now! So often cover stories before and just know what's going on before these much better funded media companies?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. You're reminding me of right around the tour of the time of the invasion of Iraq. Radio Skid Row in Sydney, Australia, had an email from a listener. Actually, I think it was a letter from a listener. This is 2003, who said, how is it that the poorest station in Australia has the best coverage of the Iraq War? Because Radio Skid Row broadcasts Democracy Now! Every day. I mean, one of these days, Webster's will redefine the term exclusive. It will be heard on Democracy Now! A year before the term is used on the major networks. I'll give you an example.
Yeah, right.
I remember when we interviewed, it was a whistleblower, someone who is, you know, involved with revealing that the NSA was spying on the American people. And we did an interview with him, an extended interview. You know, so often these folks are off limits to the corporate media. It's not that they don't know about it, but they just choose not to go with it. That's why Edward Snowden, for example, did not go to the New York Times, because the New York Times had suppressed a story by James Risen on spying. And he thought, well, if I go to them, they may never do this. And so he got in touch with Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, and they would ultimately go to Hong Kong to meet him. And now the New York Times says it's one of their great shames that he felt that the Times would not cover the story. But anyway, we had on a whistleblower. And then MSNBC wanted to have on this whistleblower. So, you know, the way TV works, at the beginning is the billboard. And, you know, we do this all the time. I'm sure you do, too, where you talk about, you know, what's coming up on the show. And on television, they flash to the different guests they're going to have. And in this case, because they were interviewing the guests live, they didn't have a clip of him speaking. They would be just about to speak to him. So they ran a clip of him on Democracy Now! Speaking. And they covered our logo on the bottom with the words, exclusive.
Right.
So they were saying that their story was exclusive with him, but the way they got the clip was pulling it from our show.
Right.
But, you know, that's our philosophy. It's steal the story, please. That's the point of this. We call it trickle-up journalism. We hope they take our stories. Sure, it would be nice to get the credit so that people would have a roadmap to independent media, where it came out first. You know, we're on this 100-city tour, which is astounding. And we're so excited to be broadcasting from Albuquerque and Santa Fe this week, doing events in Albuquerque and Santa Fe and Taos and Los Alamos. And we bring out the voices of people in their communities during this tour. And when we were at Stanford University, you know, in Palo Alto in California, we broadcast 2 days from there as we did events at Stanford and Santa Clara, Silicon Valley, and celebrated the first Pacifica radio station, KPFA, in Berkeley. It was their 67th birthday. There was a woman, formerly a journalist and an activist, who's just come out with, and this is particularly relevant to New Mexico as well, you know, she lives in Livermore, and they are taking on the major national lab there. And, of course, the other labs are Los Alamos and Sandia. And we did this whole story on their report that came out this past week called the $1 trillion Nuclear Train Wreck. And it's the amount of money that President Obama is pouring into nuclear weapons. And that story we did in the middle of last week. And on Sunday, big story, front page, New York Times, was about the $1 trillion program.
Right.
You know, we are constantly talking to people all over the country and around the world, getting stories, have our finger on the pulse of what's happening and what people are deeply concerned about. So when you go to the year, and I'm really excited in Albuquerque and Santa Fe to be having this discussion of the year 2011 and what happened in that year from, the Tunisian and Egyptian revolution to the Wisconsin mass historic protest to the Keystone XL in the summer of 2011 protest to Occupy in September 17th of 2011, you know, we were there before the protests, people predicting what would happen at Zuccotti, and then, of course, we broadcast throughout and broadcast from Zuccotti Park. I mean, we live generally, except on this 100-city tour, we're in New York. We live in the media metropolis of the world. That's where Occupy Wall Street was happening. Do you know how many days it took for the media to even begin to cover them?
Right.
And when they did, they then ridiculed them. Well, you know, we were talking to people there. Why were they camping out? Why were they making the sacrifice? And people had all different issues they were raising, from challenging Wall Street and inequality to war to the death penalty to racial injustice. And the media mocked that. They said, can't these rascals basically even figure out what they're out there for? What do you mean? They're out there for all of these issues. They see them as connected. It's not its weakness, it's its strength. And it wasn't for us to judge. It was for us to give a voice, to provide a platform for them to speak, have discussion, have debate, and then people could make up their own mind. And, you know, in the end, Occupy has had a massive effect on this country. I mean, yes, the encampments were eviscerated by the police all over the country, right? But it didn't end Occupy. These movements take all different forms. The fact is, Occupy was the most common word used that year, according to a dictionary, and, you know, that people looked up. And 1% and 99%, everyone knows what you're talking about when you say those words. Occupy occupied the language. It changed the language. And when you change the language, you change the world.
Why do you think, I mean, you talk about mainstream papers ridiculing or mocking the people in Occupy Wall Street and Democracy Now! And independent media actually listening to them and saying, asking what you were here for and reporting that. And there's a difference in culture, I think, between a set of reporters who will go out and mock the people whom they're reporting on and the culture of Democracy Now! And independent media who will listen to those people and report what they're saying. What's that about?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, we are about covering movements. Movements matter. Movements make history. And we have enormous respect for people who organize, for activists who dedicate their lives to making the world a better place. The media denigrates activists. Yet what could be more noble? It's not about agreeing with a particular person or a group, but giving voice to them. And, I mean, look at what has made this country great. Harriet Tubman is going to be on the $20 bill. That's not what makes this country great, but Harriet Tubman does. Harriet Tubman, this astounding, brave, enslaved woman who escapes soon after Frederick Douglass escapes from the eastern shore of Maryland. He speaks out around the country against slavery. She goes back to where she fled. She goes back to where she was brutalized and beaten, and she goes to save others who have been enslaved. And she was responsible for freeing hundreds upon hundreds of enslaved people. She was a conductor on what's known as the Underground Railroad. And then she would fight against slavery in the Civil War. And she would lead troops. It's an astounding story. And now, well over a century later, she is being honored. There's a controversy, you know, here she is a woman who took on capitalism, she took on slavery, right. And what does it mean to put her on the $20 bill? Well, she'll be replacing a slave-holding president, right, Andrew Jackson, though he's simply going to be moved to the back of the bill. And there's an interesting debate about this, right? Some people say, this is the currency, the most common currency we use, and it is going to educate so many people about who is great in this country. And others are saying, why should she be on money, you know, and what money has come to represent and who makes money in this country? But it's an interesting debate. But what isn't debatable is that Harriet Tubman was a part of a movement that changed this country. She was also a women's rights activist. Women's rights and abolition, the environmental movement, the lesbian and gay movement, the anti-war movement, the racial justice movement. These are the movements that have made this country great.
And I guess what I'm trying to get at is, I mean, the New York Times or any of these newspapers that might mock Occupy 20 years later or after the civil rights movement, they will deify activists. Oh. It's not that they think that activists are terrible. It's just that at the moment that it's happening, they're not getting the story.
I mean, Mary Charlotte, I think what you mean is while the activists are alive, they denigrate them. After they die, they deify them. Let's use as an example Dr. Martin Luther King. Like, if people heard this today, especially young people, they'd say, no, he was different. He was sanctified from the beginning. Hardly. April 4th, 1967, at Riverside Church in New York City, he gives his speech against the war in Vietnam. He is ridiculed. He is vilified by the corporate media. I have the Life magazine that came out right after he spoke. Dr. King was even warned by his inner circle, don't do this, Mike. That's what they called him, Mike. Don't do this, Martin. Do not speak against the war in Vietnam. It's not your war. You have the president wrapped around your finger, President Johnson. He signed the Civil Rights Act. He signed the Voting Rights Act. Do not alienate him. And Dr. King said no. And he spoke out against the war. He said it's a seamless web. And he said, my country is the greatest purveyor of violence on earth today. Oh, my gosh. The Washington Post, Time Magazine, Life Magazine. They said he sounded like he was reading a script from Radio Hanoi. They said he had done a disservice to his cause, his country, his people. And he just kept going for the year until he was gunned down April 4th, 1968, a year to the day later. So this happens, and it's such an important point that you raise, over and over again. And it is these prophets, these heretics, these troublemakers who defy the establishment, what is often called common wisdom, that is not wise at all. And that's what makes them so brave. And yes, decades later or 100 years later, they will be sanctified.
Right. It seems, I mean, you're reporting on so many different topics, and the new book, 20 Years Covering the Movements, is a wonderful book, and kind of if people want to pick it up and, you know, maybe have missed some of Democracy Now over the years, there's chapters on whistleblowers, on undocumented immigrants, on the death penalty, on climate, on LGBTQ issues, and on police killings, and so on and so on. And it seems to me, again, watching these issues as you have much more closely over all of these years, that on economic issues, which are at the root of so many of all these other things, it's the tactic of the oligarchy, of the people in power, to be patient. They try to control the narrative. Even when they can't control the narrative, they let people protest, the protests end, they keep doing business as usual, often quietly, often secretly. Where do you see the democracy movement breaking down that pattern in the long run? Not just taking to the streets, but having real change be affected once people are off the streets?
I think that movements take all different forms. They transform themselves. You know, you have Occupy, the symbol was the encampments. And these encampments were really astounding. I mean, I went to many around the country. In New York, of course, Occupy Oakland, where Scott Olson, who is the veteran from the Iraq War, was shot in the head by police, a beanbag projectile that almost killed him, ended up settling with the police for millions and millions and millions of dollars. But how can anyone pay for that kind of mortal wound? Then being in Louisville, Kentucky, and going late one night to find the Occupy. You knew in every town there would be one, and there was the Occupy tents, and I went, and the first guy to pop out of his tent around midnight was an Iraq War vet. And I said to him, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "I serve my country in Iraq, and I'm serving my country here." So this is all 2011, and you're saying what happens when they're off the streets, when they're out of the encampments. I think it takes all different forms. I mean, look now at the 2016 presidential race. The shock of the corporate media around the massive rallies that are drawn to Bernie Sanders, right? He is drawing the largest rallies in the history of U.S. presidential politics. And the shock of the media, like, where are all these people coming from? Well, you know, the movement has ebbed and flowed, and it's getting ever larger. Where it goes this year, we cannot say. But it is, I think, consolidating. It's coalescing. Hillary Clinton has heard their call. She understands that she might have been taken down by this absolute demand that we take on the greatest inequality in a century in this country, that people are suffering terribly. And she has allied herself with Wall Street for a very long time. She understands that this movement is not going to be mollified by simply, you know, mouthing some platitudes. You talk about the establishment containing the protests. They've hardly contained Black Lives Matter. Now, the Black Lives Matter activists understand that they're not going to get handed a microphone by the corporate networks. Yeah, here, invite you to the studios and say your piece. And so they grab the microphone at these presidential rallies, everywhere from, you know, Bernie Sanders at Netroots Nation to Martin O'Malley when he was running, remember, Ancient History for the Democratic nomination, and then for Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton, you know, there's an interesting difference between Clinton and Sanders. Sanders does his fundraising on the campaign trail, right? It's his way, the way he's raised these record amounts of money. 6 million people contributing. It's actually way beyond that now. You know, $44 million in the month of March when Hillary Clinton raised something like $29 million. And she's maxing out her donors, right? They give top dollar. His donors are giving $3, $6, $9, $27, so they can keep on giving. But He raises money on the campaign trail just by saying it at a rally. She has to go off the campaign trail to private fundraisers to make her money. And there, Black Lives Matter activists, like recently in South Carolina, they somehow managed to infiltrate, open a banner that says something like, "I am not a super predator," referring to her comments in 1996 about black youth, some black youth, as she was endorsing her husband, President Bill Clinton's, 1994 crime bill that led to mass incarceration. These movements are coalescing right now, and their young people are understanding the past, and they are bringing, they are modernizing the civil rights movement, addressing the issues of today. And I don't think necessarily they are being contained. I think they are challenging the establishment in very deep ways.
Let's talk about police killings of unarmed citizens. Racism obviously plays a huge role, and there are so many names that have now become part of our daily life. Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, so many others, Freddie Gray. And yet, there's more going on. Here in New Mexico, we have white officers killing white men and women. There are officers of all races killing people, killing homeless people, killing mentally ill people across the country. And there seems to be this kind of epidemic of police killings, of anger and fear among the police. Race is part of it, but it's not just race. How do you understand this whole phenomenon?
We have a chapter in our new book, Democracy Now!, the book, as opposed to the show, where we just give a list of 1 year's toll of people killed by police.
Yeah.
And it is a tiny fraction of the people who are killed in the year. And it is terrifying, as you said. I mean, look at the case of Sandra Bland, this woman who was going to start work at her alma mater, Prairie View A&M in Texas, is pulled over because the police officer, it probably wasn't true, by the way, said she did not signal a lane change. And before you know it, and we know this because there was a video cam on the police car, he is telling her to put out her cigarette in her car, which, to say the least, was shocking. She was in her own car. And then telling her to get out, and she was scared. In fact, she was a Black Lives Matter activist. She'd posted a number of video on her Facebook page taking on police brutality, and she was scared here. She knew she was now in this situation. You know, she's saying, "Whoa, what have I done wrong?" And he says, "I'm going to light you up." She knows she has to get out of this car, that this is out of control right now. And before you know it, you hear her saying, "You're slamming my head into the pavement. Why? I have epilepsy." You hear him saying, "Good." She's put in jail. Let's remember why she was put in jail. She was put in jail. She, if it's even true, she didn't signal a lane change, around 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. What are you talking about?
Right.
And she can't get out of jail because she can't post the bond. And so she's there for 3 days, and she ends up dead in her jail cell. They say she committed suicide. Her family doesn't believe it. But the reason I'm raising this is here you have that situation. Then, as you said, it's not only African Americans. It is the story of unbridled power that has gone unchallenged for a long time. And now there's an accountability movement. Thanks, for example, to the people of Ferguson, who rose up after Michael Brown was gunned down, 18 years old, and left to lay in the hot August sun hour after hour after hour. And the people rose up in this poor community, and they wouldn't stop. We raced to Ferguson. We covered the period after the killing of Michael Brown. And then we went back when the non-indictment came down. And I remember talking to young people. You know, the networks did go to cover the Ferguson protests, and they really showed well because their own reporters were getting tear gassed, the militarization of police.
Yeah.
But we were there to give voice to the people who were on the front lines. They weren't just wallpaper for us. They weren't just a backdrop for us to, voice our reports. These people were the reason we were there. And as one young man told me, shivering in the cold, his breath visible in the freezing night air as he faced off with riot police, "We're going to shake the heavens." And shake the heavens they did. We raced back to Staten Island, we were covering the killing of Eric Garner, right, the African-American 43-year-old man who was taken down by police in a chokehold, and as he gasped 11 times, "I can't breathe," they piled on him. And it was only a young man who flipped open his phone videoing this that lets us know what even happened. And when the protest took place in Staten Island, you know, 1,000 people strong, I was interviewing, I mean, these were kids who were protesting. I don't mean 18-year-olds. I don't mean 20-year-olds. I mean 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds with crayon posters they were carrying. And I spoke to one girl, Anaya. She had just turned 13. And I asked her, why was she out protesting? And she said, "I just want to live till I'm 18.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the American dream today, to live till I am 18. This is not acceptable. And it's young people who are really challenging the establishment right now, challenging police departments, one after the other being put under Justice Department review. And it's coming from the grassroots.
The movement to stop the building of the Keystone XL pipeline is something that you covered for a very long time. That movement was successful. Now, various companies want to build other pipelines that seem to be perhaps just as bad. But what do you see as the long-term effect of this success in stopping Keystone?
It's so significant what took place also in the year 2011 with that ring around the Rose Garden, with thousands of people protesting President Obama at the White House, 1,200 people getting arrested, and among them, Naomi Klein was first arrested there, you know, the great author and activist who wrote This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate, wrote Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, and before that, No Logo, taking aim at brand bullies. You know, everyone should read all her books. Bill McKibben was arrested there, the founder of 350.org. I think even some in the movement thought that it was symbolic. They didn't know if they could stop the Keystone XL, but it's important to rally around something specific. It took years. And it is so significant because I think that movement is also taking on fracking. And that's a big issue. As we travel the country on this 100-city tour, fracking is a key issue. It's a big difference, by the way, between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, right? Bernie Sanders, the senator from Vermont, has said no fracking. Hillary Clinton is much more measured, hoping not to be pushed into, you know, having to make this statement. But, you know, it sort of reminds you back in 2003 about, you know, at the time of the Iraq War, when she voted for the Iraq War. She doesn't want to find herself in this position, because I do think that's the reason she wasn't president then. Because in the Democratic primary, it was the main difference between her and Barack Obama. Barack Obama then prevailed in the primary, and then he ultimately won. She knows what it means to take such a position, and she has been certainly educated about the power of movements this year. So she's trying to skirt around this as best she can, as she is around the fair trade deals. I should say, what the corporate media, when they talk about free trade, what it really is, corporate managed trade, and the movements are pushing her, and they are shaping the future.
I find myself looking at all the different movements that you write about, and most of them have to do with economics in one way or another. So climate activists are threatening the power of the fossil fuel companies, and WTO activists threaten the whole worldwide corporate capitalism, and the movement of undocumented immigrants is about taking power of a group that is vastly exploited economically. And then you have a few movements which aren't explicitly about an economic class, like the LGBTQ equality movement, marriage equality and non-discrimination. LGBTQ people don't really constitute an economic class. It's something else. It's a different kind of prejudice. And I find myself wondering whether the success of that movement, and it's been a wonderful, amazing success, it's come very far in a relatively short time, doesn't have to do with the fact that nobody's going to suffer economically by that movement's, or no people in power are going to suffer economically by that movement's success. I wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, you know, that's very interesting, and the organizing that's gone on in the gay, lesbian, trans, queer movement for all of these years has been utterly creative. It's a matter of life and death. You know, go back to Stonewall, where the modern day movement began, really launched the gay and lesbian movement of today, trans movement. You cannot talk about Stonewall, you know, that bar in the village not far from where Democracy Now! Generally broadcasts, without talking about trans power. And it hasn't been talked about that very much in the past. I really lived that, not at the time that it took place, but when I worked with Dave Isay, the great oral historian, Dave, who has started StoryCorps, and it's the largest oral history project in this country, but he began at WBAI in New York, my station in our newsroom. And I edited a documentary he did called Stonewall. So I lived the descriptions of everyone from the officers to the activists who couldn't take it anymore when the police came to raid their bar. And those that fought back were really trans activists, you know, taking their high heels and hammering away on the heads of the police. Even the police describe how shocked they were by the just unbridled despair and anger of the people they had arrested and abused for so long. And to hear people like Sylvia Rivera talk about just having had it that night, something broke inside. You know, Sylvia Rivera, and this is also goes to the intersectionality of the movements, was also a young lord. I want to go back to what you mentioned with Juan Gonzalez, my great colleague. We have together hosted Democracy Now! For this full 20 years. Juan, you talked about going to the WTO on our dime with us, his other DN, Democracy Now!, because the biggest city paper in the country at the time, the Daily News, said the WTO, the who? And so he went with us, had to take time off, and then they're calling him every minute. He's saying, wait a second, I am busy. I'm working with Democracy Now! They said, what are you talking about? You work for us. We need our front page stories. Now, I just wanted to digress, if you would allow me for a minute, at just making this a free association from Sylvia Rivera, who actually was active in the Young Lords, the Puerto Rican equivalent to the Black Panthers, and Juan Gonzalez, who is one of the founders of the Young Lords. His journalism is to be revered, is to be studied. I hope that it is copied by young people who deeply care about the importance of independent media and telling the stories of people who are not usually heard. In the introduction to our book, Democracy Now!, we couldn't end that introduction without talking about Juan. A few weeks ago, he announced he's leaving the Daily News. He's retiring. He's going to be a professor at Rutgers in New Jersey, but he is staying with his other DN, with Democracy Now! And we had the privilege a few months ago to go up to Midtown Manhattan, the whole gang, the whole team of Democracy Now!, to honor Juan when he became the first Latino journalist to be inducted into the New York Journalism Hall of Fame. And his speech put the other inductees to shame. And I'm talking about Charlie Rose and Leslie Stahl. This was such a big moment. And I just wanted to read a bit of what Juan said that lunchtime afternoon as he was inducted. He said, I figured my modest contribution would be not writing about outcast neighborhoods, but from them. Not simply to entertain, but to change. Not after the fact, but before it, when coverage could still make a difference. He said, I've tried to use as many of my columns as possible to probe the injustices visited upon the powerless. Yes, the rich and famous are also victims on occasion, but they have so many politicians, lobbyists, lawyers, gossip columnists, and even editorial writers ready to jump to their defense that they'll always do fine without my help. Juan said, I prefer the desperate unknown reader who comes to me because he or she has gone everywhere else and no one will listen. More often than not, I come across unexpected gems, human beings whose tragedies illuminate the landscape, and whose courage hopefully inspires the reader to believe that there is indeed some greater good served by a free press than just chronicling or influencing the ouster of one group of politicians by another. Those are the words of Juan Gonzalez that inspire me every day. Juan inspires me. And the book that we wrote isn't about, you know, like greatest hits of Democracy Now. It's not an exhaustive history of the movements. But we just wanted to celebrate some of the ordinary heroes who've done extraordinary things to make the world a better place. Among them, Juan Gonzalez.
Before we go, I wanted to ask you one thing, and that is, what do you see in the next generation of young journalists, investigative journalists, independent media? Where do you see Democracy Now and other independent media organizations going?
I hope Democracy Now is a model for independent journalism, not only in this country, but around the world. You know, now we have many documentarians who come, journalists who come from around the world to do pieces on Democracy Now. You know, they come to our New York studios, they interview us. And the reason is because they don't have this kind of model of journalism. They have corporate media, they understand that, private companies that own a channel. They have state media. They get that when the state is putting out their line. But this kind of independent listener, viewer, reader-supported journalism is more unusual. And we deeply believe in this. I mean, KSFR is such an important place, and it's supported by the listeners. And it's a model that has been used for decades in this country, and I think it is the model of the future. At Democracy Now, we are training another generation of independent journalists. We have everyone from fourth graders to graduate students in journalism to mid-career journalists from around the world coming to watch the broadcast all the time, every week, because it's a real happening. It's 8 Eastern Standard Time in the morning. They watch the broadcast. Sometimes they'll interview the guests afterwards who come out of our studio. But we also have fellowships and internships, seriously working with young people to cover the critical issues of the day. And in the last weeks, two of our reporters, Tarina Nadura, who started with us, she was at Brooklyn College, and she then became an intern at Democracy Now, and then a fellow, and now is one of our video producers. She and our video fellow, Juan Carlos Davila from University of California, Santa Cruz, went out to cover an anti-Trump rally in New York. About 1,000 people were there. They were on this Grand Central Bridge right above Grand Central. They had a bird's eye view of the mass protests. But also the police were arresting people on the bridge, and they were filming. And the police went after them. You even hear a higher-level supervising officer saying, don't, they're filming. You have to let them film. But they pushed Juan Carlos's face into the ground. And it's so important that journalists be there. You know, it's much easier if they, when the police say leave, you just up and leave. But the problem with that is we have a responsibility to go to where the silence is. We have a responsibility to document, to hold those in power to account. And if we just leave, then we are abrogating our responsibility. But it shouldn't be when we're documenting what the police do that our lives are put in danger, that we can be injured. And that's exactly what happened with my colleagues. And so it is going through this process. You know, my colleague Sharif Abdelkaddous and Nicole Salazar were arrested at the Republican convention in 2008. That was the convention that nominated John McCain and Sarah Palin. And I raced out to have them released to the area in St. Paul where they had been brutalized by the police, bloodied, and arrested. And as soon as I went to say we need to have our reporters released, they arrested me. This is not acceptable. There is a reason why our profession, journalism, is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we're supposed to be the check and balance on power. We take that responsibility seriously.
Amy Goodman, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, it's been an honor. And Mary Charlotte, I look forward to seeing you in Santa Fe and to coming to New Mexico. This is a place that is so close to my heart. We're going to be in Los Alamos. We're going to be doing events in Taos. We're going to be doing an event tonight in Albuquerque and tomorrow night at the Lensic in Santa Fe, and I really can't wait.
Amy Goodman is host of Democracy Now! The new book is Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering Movements Changing America. She will be speaking on Tuesday, the 26th of April, at 7:30 at the Lensic Center for Performing Arts. It's a benefit for KSFR, KNME, and KUNM, all public media serving New Mexico. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a moment with Dennis Moynihan. Please stay tuned. And we're back. We've got just a couple of minutes left. I want to introduce Dennis Moynihan, who is co-author of the new book, Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America. And Dennis, you were here to talk about something that's happening tonight in Albuquerque.
Right. And it's such an honor to be coming to northern New Mexico and to meet all the listeners of KSFR. Tonight, we have kind of an interesting event. It's going to be a benefit for a low-power FM project. So this is a new and emerging, it's not entirely new, but it's a vastly increased sector of the public media with a efflorescence of small community stations that are called low-power FMs sprouting up around the country. We have two in Denver, where I live, that I'm helping put together. The one in Albuquerque is licensed to a great media nonprofit called Quote Unquote that used to run the public access channels in Albuquerque. They're still a nonprofit running media education and empowerment, training people to create their own media. They are going to construct this low-power FM radio station on the grounds of the Robert F. Kennedy Charter High School in the South Valley of Albuquerque. And that high school, now, so I actually managed to get a portable radio tower delivered. I delivered it to the high school last December, and they're constructing the station bit by bit, and this benefit's going to help them accomplish that. The school, if you're not familiar, Robert F. Kennedy Charter High School, and we hear, if you're a regular listener to Democracy Now!, you know to be very suspicious of the charter school movement and how the corporate entities are trying to take over and profit from the educational system. I can only say that the Robert F. Kennedy High School, Charter High School in South Valley of Albuquerque, is the absolute antithesis of that. This is a very innovative school that serves a population of students who are largely undocumented, and it teaches them not only the three R's, but also the skills they need as young adults to survive in an economy that is, in a society that is hostile to the undocumented. So vocational training with skills like auto body, car repair, how to own and operate a child care center, how to own and operate a food truck. Organized with Robert Beatty, the director, who's such a kind of innovative thinker, trained in the organizing tactics of Saul Alinsky and how to really mobilize people for effective change. So I really encourage people to think about, one, coming out to the Lensic Tuesday night, because that's going to be a great event to have Amy Goodman doing a great talk at the Lensic. It's something that I can never do enough of, and I love the fact that the Lensic, you know, as Bob Martin steps down, the staff there rallied. They have a busy schedule. They squeezed in this event, so I really encourage folks to come out. The Monday event tonight in Albuquerque is going to be at the site of the Robert F. Kennedy Charter High School. At 5:30, they have three or four food trucks that they use as actual learning labs to teach people how to own and operate their own trucks. Those are going to be open at 5:30. So come hungry, have some food at the food trucks. By 7, we'll be seated in this stellar new multi-purpose building that they've built down there. And it's such a beautiful facility. It's at 4300 Blake Road Southwest in Albuquerque. So if you don't get over to that side of town too often, I encourage you to come out, meet us there, take a tour of the campus. It's a great place that the Albuquerque schools supports. And I just can't say enough how important it is to learn about these emerging stations, this kind of new media that's serving small areas of big cities and small rural areas. We have, like I said, two starting up in Denver, and it's really wonderful to see that Albuquerque is going to be getting its own. And I really encourage you to come out, and I thank you for, you know, having Amy on, and obviously for the work you do every day on your program.
Thank you, Dennis. Dennis Moynihan is co-author of the new book, Democracy Now!, along with Amy Goodman and David Goodman. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.